is more important than it ever has been. You truly are the pathway for the people to see the truth that's going on. So in this moment of time, my message to all of you is continue to speak just in an unjust room. Regardless of the consequences, regardless of the backlash, we're with you. We need that truth, and continue to spread that truth for us, because people need to know what's truly going on so we can game plan as far as how to fight against these oppressive forces.
So that was Colin Kaepernick, who can't get a job in the NFL because he took the knee protesting police brutality. From this protest to the Me Too movement, Alan Aaron, we just have 30 seconds. What gives you hope?
Well, the majority of people who voted actually voted against Trump on the popular basis in the last election are rejecting this attempt at rightist revolution. But they cannot succeed unless there's a massive mobilization that's persistent and doesn't stop because of all the structural obstacles that have built in. But in the November congressional election, if the Republicans can be swept out of control of the House and the Senate, and if people take to the streets
there,
like
Alan,
they did in Honduras,
this is Democracy Now. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Did you know that everything you hear on KBOO Radio is now archived on the KBOO website? Music, news, public affairs, it's all there for you to listen on demand. And podcast. Look up your favorite KBOO shows by name on iTunes or your favorite podcasting software. You can listen when you want, share a link to a program you heard on the radio. You can go to our website, kboo.fm, and click on audio. All the audio is there, and playlists for music shows are shown along with the audio recording, so you can follow along to find out the artists and titles of the songs that you hear. Again, it's all right there on kboo.fm, on iTunes, or the KBOO app.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
Hope you might join us on New Year's Day of 2018 from 8 a.m. to noon for a special Michael Wells Memorial Dawn Concert. Michael Wells was a longtime KBOO volunteer, programmer, and worked as station manager and board member. Michael passed away last year. His many friends from KBOO and his family thought it would be a nice gesture to honor him by having a special Dawn Concert program to start the new year. In the early days of KBOO, Dawn Concert was a regularly scheduled morning program with a variety of program hosts. That's Dawn Concert honoring the late Michael Wells from 8 a.m. to noon on Monday, January 1st, 2018. Thank you.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show is off today. Instead, it's a special presentation of the Union Edge Labor Talk Radio. At 9 on Alternative Radio, economist Edward Herman, co-author with Noam Chomsky of the legendary book Manufacturing Consent, speaks on the propaganda model. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on stage and studio, D-May Roberts speaks to musician Joe Kai about his new album, and he'll perform songs from the album Migrants. At 11:30 on Art Focus, talks to Eric Bone of Metalwood Salvage, a Northeast Portland workshop that intercepts usable and unique material and turns it into furniture, fixtures, and art. Today's weather calls for a mix of clouds and sun with temperatures hovering around the freezing mark. There's a slight chance of snow beginning around the time of the evening rush hour. KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on donate to become a member. And now, The Union Edge.
The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio, reminds you to register to vote, educate yourself on the issues, be part of the process.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labor.
More money is flowing out of Africa because of tax evasion and other illicit activities than is going into the continent to help it develop. Trade unions are in the forefront of the efforts to help stop these illicit financial flows known as IFFs. I talked to Caroline Kamati Mugala about money illegally leaking out of Africa. Ms. Mugala is the executive secretary of the East Africa Trade Union Confederation. I asked her to describe illicit financial flows known as IFFs.
In simple terms, illicit financial flows basically means illegal movement of money or capital from one country to another. And when I say illegal movement of money, we are talking about things like, a drug cartel using trade-based money laundering techniques to mix legal money from sale with illegal money, or when you're talking about an importer using trade misinvoicing to evade customs duty, VAT, or income tax, or we are talking about, corrupt public official using an anonymous shell company or bank account, to siphon money from a particular country, or, money that is being lost through human trafficking or terrorism. So basically, that's what illicit financial flows is.
How much money is leaving Africa because of these illicit financial flows?
In general, around 192 billion leaves Africa every year. That is through illicit financial flow being one of it, one of the ways money leaves Africa, vis-a-vis 134 billion that we received. But through the Mbeki report that was commissioned by the African Union and led by the former president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, they put the figure on illicit financial flows at a conservative figure of 50 billion leaving the country every day. But Mark, something interesting about this 50 billion, only 3% represents corruption. And around 30 to 35% represent, through criminal means. But a big percentage, which is between 60 to 60%, is through commercial. So this means through multinational cooperation in terms of losing tax. So from Thabo Mbeki's report, only 3% is through what we call corruption.
The money that is being lost because of illicit financial flows, what could it be used for?
We are looking at money that would have been used for public resourcing, to fight poverty in East Africa. We are talking about money that could be used to better access, key services like quality education, healthcare, social protection, reproductive health rights, and so forth. But you see also, when I look at these public resources that are needed and are being siphoned out of Africa, one of the marginalized groups that is highly affected is also women. Because when you talk about education that is not quality, healthcare that is not quality, lack of social protection, a majority of the population that is affected is women and young people. The other way that, East Africa is losing out is, you see, since government cannot raise revenue through collecting tax from these companies, or this company is not paying their fair share, it means that in one way or another, you know, the East African governments still have to raise revenues. But where do they raise these revenues from? One of the easiest way that they do to raise revenues through what you call value addition tax. This is taxing basic goods like milk, water. We are talking about sanitary pads for the women. We are talking about salt. We are talking about food. And this directly hits our work at home.
And that's it. International labor news you can use. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about global solidarity.
Happy holidays from the Union Edge Laborist Talk Radio. So happy that you could join us. This week, we're replaying some of our favorite interviews of the year. Check it out.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborist Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate it. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in the Union Edge. This program is sponsored in part by the UFCW and the BCTGM. That's United Food and Commercial Workers International and the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco, Grain Millers Union. Yeah, BC, the cookie guys and gals. We appreciate their support. Stay away from Mexican-made Oreos. I'm just saying, stay away from Mexican-made Oreos. Look on the back of the box or look on the backs of the – if it says made in Mexico, leave it on the shelf. In studio today, we have Dr. Professor Charles McAllister, former professor of Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Doctor.
Great to be here.
Thank you for being here. Yes, sir. You also work for Westinghouse, making Union Switch and Signal.
Right, Union Switch and Signal, yep.
So we appreciate that. Charlie, you brought a friend today.
Yes,
I'm excited.
Did. And he's a very good friend and a person I admire greatly, Wally Jamal, one of the great interpreters here locally of one of our greatest playwright, for one of the greatest playwrights of America, if not the greatest playwright, August Wilson, whose 10-play cycle on basically on Pittsburgh really is just one of the extraordinary achievements of American literature. And we're really fortunate to have seen some of the greatest presentations of that. Wally, and last week we had Salahuddin. These are people who have played August Wilson up close and personal and know the roots from whence he came and interpret him better than Denzel Washington, in my opinion. Wally Jamal.
Hey, wait a second. Wally, I got to ask you a quick question. You're in one of the acting unions, right?
Yes, Actors Equity and SAG-AFTRA.
Oh, okay. See, because now, if you weren't in SAG-AFTRA, I was going to have to defend, you know, my brother in SAG. But since you're okay, we're good.
And I was in Local 6471 Musicians Union. I was in that. I'm a drummer.
I get it. I understand.
I'm total union.
Yeah, it's frustrating for me, and I'll tell you why. Angela Bachman, who has been working, we've been working together on this project for since she was in her 20s.
Easy.
We've got that close working relationship, but the long as she is and Brittany is and Carol and Laura are all very creative, artistic, you know, they do those kinds of things. I'm like wrong brained, you know. It's like I couldn't hold a beat if you gave me a bucket. You know,
she did the lighting for John Henry at the August Wilson Center.
So. Awesome. And they got a great grid and state-of-the-art equipment there.
Yeah. And they got hurt, too. So, you know, it's like, you know. So, but, yeah, she,
they got the sound, know, sound got the not talent. Lighting. Sound, sound. I got it wrong. Yeah, she did the sound.
Yeah, and quite honestly, you know, she won't toot her horn, but I'll toot it for her. She's one of the best audio people in the town.
Right.
She awesome. Is, really. And I'm very proud to call her my friend and my buddy, even though I dog her out on a regular basis. But so, well, you know, this is exciting.
Yeah, we want to talk about what I consider the greatest Pittsburgher, or certainly one of the very greatest Pittsburghers, Martin Delaney. And when we discovered and started to get to know each other, and I mean, I had really thought the world of Martin Delaney and read a lot about him, and hardly anybody else did, and I put him in my book, and then found Wally, who even knew more about him than I did, and who had written a play about him, which he put on with Mike Stout as General Sherman.
Yeah. And he was great.
And he was awesome. He was awesome. He really got into it.
He actually looks a little like Sherman.
It's a Kentucky breeding.
But Martin Delaney, tell us about Martin Delaney a little bit here.
Well, Martin Delaney, abridged version, he was born in 1812. By the time he was like 5 or 6 years old, his mother was teaching him and his siblings how to read, which was against the law in Charlestown, Virginia, which is now West Virginia. And once it was found out that she was teaching them to read, there was a warrant out for her arrest, though they had to sell their house, which the local banker gave them a...
She was free. His father was a slave, and she was free.
Right. His father was a slave, and he was allowed to go and see them every now and then. And one time during one of his furloughs, his furlough was rescinded, and he refused to go back. And so the deputy and the sheriff came to try to, you know, take him back. And he took what was called a swingle tree, which is that long piece of wood that goes between horses on a wagon, and he fought them off with that until they finally subdued him. But once they got out of Charlestown, they went to Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and they were able to save up and buy their father's freedom. Yeah, and brought him to Chambersburg with them, and they eventually all came to Pittsburgh after Martin Delaney walked from Chambersburg to Pittsburgh. It's about 150 miles, and he would work at a farm in Bedford for a while and catch a ride on a wagon here and there, but for the most part, he walked. And once he got to Pittsburgh, he met with some of the greatest veterans of the War of 1812, and a lot of them got messed over by the government on their pension and the land and the money they were promised, but a lot of them did get it. And a lot of them, and it wasn't really necessarily a black-white thing, you know. It's just like
it was. You were a GI, and we were going to stick it to you.
Yeah, and they became very prominent businessmen here in Pittsburgh. John B. Vachon owned a lot of property up until the Great Fire of 1845, which burned everything from Smithfield Street all the way to the point, to the tip of the point. And Martin Delaney actually had a newspaper going during the time of that fire, and his newspaper, The Mystery, was the only newspaper to have a blow-by-blow rundown of that fire, which started with a washerwoman and some cinders.
Supposedly, they're always blaming the Irish washerwoman.
This old lady Leary in Chicago, right? Then they blamed the cow. You know, they blamed her, and she blamed the cow. And it was a hot time in the old town that night.
Yeah, for sure.
But to go further, he had the first newspaper, and he, ironically, was sued for libel by another black person that he did a story about helping slave catchers. And they would basically kidnap people off the street. Primarily, they would snatch the people who would give the less resistance, and that was little kids. So our children weren't safe to walk the streets. And there was this guy, his name was Thomas Fiddler Johnson, and Martin Delaney put him on blast. They did an article about him and put him out there, and he was advised, this guy Thomas Fiddler Johnson was advised by some crooked lawyer to sue the paper for libel. And he won and bankrupted the newspaper. The upside to that was shortly after the paper went defunct in 1847, Frederick Douglass came to Pittsburgh to start his newspaper, which became the more famous North Star. And if you look at the first editions of the North Star, you look up in the left-hand corner, you will see as the editors Frederick Douglass, Martin Delaney. And he's just so unsung, and he's so part of, like, following his life was following 19th century America that nobody knows anything about. The average person if you ask them about the 19th century, they'll go maybe from the War of 1812 straight to the Civil War, and leaving all those decades untalked about, undiscussed, like with the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850, Uncle Tom's Cabin coming out in 1850. In the 1840s, the end of that was the Gold Rush, and before that, there was the Trail of Tears, and just so much history that people just don't know about. And my studying Martin Delaney revealed all of that to me. So I'm kind of an expert on the 19th century now, because he was so involved in so much of it.
He was. And we're going to have, in the next section, we're going to have him do Martin the most, to me, the greatest speech ever given in Pittsburgh in the Allegheny marketplace here on the north side, in against the fugitive slave law. And he does this in a way that nobody else does.
Yeah, he gives it to him. He lets them know. He's like, ladies and gentlemen, honorable mayor, whatever ideas I have of liberty have been gained through the reading of your revolutionary fathers. I have therein learned that a man has the right to protect his home as his castle with his life, even unto the taking of life. Sir, my home is my castle, and in it are none but my wife and my children, whose liberty is as sacred as the pillars of God. If any man approach that house in pursuit of a slave, I care not who he may be, let it be sheriff or deputy, let it be magistrate or justice, nay, let it be he who signed this ridiculous act into law, President Millard Fillmore. If he cross the threshold of my door and I do not lay him a lifeless corpse at my feet, may the grave refuse my body a resting place in righteous heaven above, my spirit a home. Oh no, he cannot enter that house and we both live. And him being a person of color, giving a speech so rousing and so angry and so American.
Mm-hmm.
Amen.
And he was as dark as my hat. My hat is black. And I mean, to me, that just spoke beyond bravery. It spoke beyond courageous. It spoke beyond self-righteous. And he was a firebrand, and I love studying him, and I want the world to know about him. So I have a...
Waller, I'm going to stop you there.
Okay, because I will go.
I'm going to stop you right there because I can see you warming up.
Yeah. Get the hook.
We're giving you a water break.
I will go. Yeah, thank you.
I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio.
Let's talk about two daily essentials, breakfast and, of course, beer. Mass marketers of breakfast cereals have been in a downward sales spiral for about a decade, so they're pitching their products as health food, hoping to woo millennials who want cereals with natural ingredients and no artificial additives. Some brands are seeking good-for-you credibility by buying out organic brands, such as Kashi, consumed by Kellogg's. But the shift of this $10 billion market to healthier alternatives is, in fact, an enormous grassroots victory, driven by the organic movement, public interest groups, fearless nutritionists, and especially by countless moms, dads, and kids who simply refused to swallow the industry's crap. Now, beer. Last year, Anheuser-Busch InBev mounted a multimillion dollar coup on America. Not on our country, but on its name. For 6 months, the beer behemoth expropriated our nation's name for a tacky advertising campaign, rebranding its Budweiser product America. But the PR ploy backfired when a flurry of stinging media stories pointed out that Bud is owned by a Brazilian consortium based in Belgium. Undeterred by facts, Big Bud announced that it has invested beaucoup bucks here to improve its beer quality. Mostly, though, that enhancement has come from buying out 10 local craft breweries. AB InBev grabbed these independent brew makers because they represent the real beer of today's America, rapidly taking customers away from the giant purveyor of bland suds. This is Jim Hightower saying, last year, the sales of Bud were down by a third from its peak sales year. Meanwhile, craft breweries are gaining market share. Production of their good beer was up 12% last year to 24 million barrels.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in and listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio during your holidays. I'm Brittany Sheets, and we have put together a really great selection of just past interviews and some of our favorite labor battles, and we really hope that you guys enjoy listening to it as much as we have as we put this together for you. So happy holidays, and thanks for tuning in.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We enjoy your company. We appreciate all the great stuff that you're doing for the community, that's for sure. This program is sponsored in part by the UAW Local 862 and IBEW Local 141. We appreciate their support. In studio today, Charlie McCullister.
Great to be here.
Always a pleasure. Also, guest with us today, Wally Jamal. Wally, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thank you for coming. No, seriously, thank you for coming in. We've been excited about this since Charlie told us.
Right.
I can't tell you how funny it is that, you know, I mean, if you ask the average Pittsburgher about Martin Delaney, it'd be, yeah, the Irish guy, right? Yeah, nah, not so much. But the amount of just really cool history that we have in the Pittsburgh area, and some of the things that have gone on in labor in the Pittsburgh area. And as much as Charlie and Rosemary run around and try and get the state of Pennsylvania or the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to put those damn placards out, there are nuances. I mean, down in Homestead, that, you know, my God. And then, you know, what's it used to be the Homestead High Level Bridge, but now it's the Homestead Gray's Bridge. And, you know, why is that? And then some of the buildings there.
I was born at Homestead.
Yeah, you know, and you know, I mean, we here at the Union Edge are blessed. We walk amongst giants, Charlie, Rosemary.
And I think the link with Homestead, and we're trying to develop that, and I did write Mark Rylance, and we'll talk about that later, but that the link between the struggle against slavery, led here by Martin Delaney and people like John Brown and Frederick Douglass, because Frederick Douglass met with John Brown in Chambersburg too, and John Brown tried to get him to talk him into doing it, and most people saw, as Delaney I think did, that this was kind of a suicide mission,
right,
that was not going to succeed. But on the other hand, they really respected this Old Testament prophet who was John Brown. John mm-hmm. Brown was a very serious character, willing to put his life on the line here.
I mean, with the Pottawatomie Massacre years before that, he and his sons, I mean, just for these people talking about slavery, right, being pro-slavery, that they hacked them to pieces with sabers.
When I talk about labor and when we talk about, the other awesome things that we did here in the Pittsburgh area, I went to Geneva College when I got out of the military, okay? And Geneva, the college almost lost its college because it was part of the railroad.
Oh.
Okay? And there are the buildings and the structures where they were hiding people are still there. And the college got caught a couple of times. Apparently, they weren't very good at smuggling, but they got caught a couple of times, and they just kept on doing it.
Yeah, well, Pittsburgh was a major place for slave snatching, where they grabbed people and then spirited them out of town.
Right, because you can put them right on a boat, take them straight through Ohio down into Kentucky, where the first of the slave auctions would be, where you would begin your journey further and further down the river as being sold down the river.
And one of the major passages north was up through Indiana County, because there was a very active group of abolitionists there who moved people along toward the North Star and toward toward freedom in Canada.
If they were lucky to make it here, there was a network of people. And studying Martin Delaney, I was able to find out about these other people, like David Peck, who was a wig maker and a clothier, and he had a restaurant that was called the House of Oysters. And we're talking about the 1830s that he had this open. Mm-hmm. And it was only open in the month with an R in it. And then there was Martin Delaney's grandfather-in-law, Charles Richards. They called him Daddy Ben. He was a butcher. He became the first black millionaire in Pittsburgh. He got the government contract in the war of 1812 to supply the army with meat, because the competitors they wouldn't be able to keep their meat fresh longer than Daddy Ben. Their meat would be green and wormy, and he would keep his preserved for a while. So he got the entire contract, and he bought up houses all around downtown Pittsburgh. And Martin Delaney married his beautiful granddaughter
and named their children Ethiopia and Ali, Ethiopia.
Yeah. Named his one son Toussaint Louverture Delaney, another one was Charles Lennox Ramon Delaney, Placido Ramses Delaney. They had some names, Jack.
But one of the extraordinary things to me, the most extraordinary things, is that he meets with John Brown, but he decides he'd had this longstanding dream of creating a free labor cotton industry that would destroy the South.
Yes.
He wanted, originally his novel was about doing that in Cuba, but mm-hmm. he decides to go to Africa to find land and bring educated African Americans from here mm-hmm. to there, and to try to help create a cotton industry that would destroy the South through free labor rather than slave labor.
And who knew growing cotton better than the people who actually did it here in America. Exactly. And that would have been amazing if he could have pulled that off.
Right. And he signed a treaty with a
King Dahomey.
Yeah.
King Dahomey.
Right.
Yeah. And no joke, his name's Dahomey. Yeah.
and then they go to London in 1860.
Yeah.
And there is a major scientific conference in which people from all over the world come to lay their explorations and their scientific discoveries. This is one of the biggest international conferences. And Delaney is asked by the English nobility to come and to talk about his trip in the Niger Delta in Africa, which whites couldn't get much more than 30 miles inside of the Niger Delta without dying of malaria. Mm-hmm. African Americans had much more resistance. So he was able to walk way up into the north of the Nigeria. So he gets asked to present to his findings, and the American delegation of many Southerners stand up and say, we're going to walk out.
Yeah,
they said, what are your qualifications for speaking to this body? Mm-hmm. And he said,
I am a man.
Yes.
And the crowd goes nuts.
Right. And that becomes then, what's that, Memphis?
Right.
The carrying of that sign, I am a man.
I am a man. Yep.
Through W.B. Du Bois, I believe.
Who studied Martin Delaney, one of the very few people of his time that studied Martin Delaney. It was great. Another guy was named George Washington Williams, who was W.E.B. Du Bois' very good friend. And Du Bois touted him as being the best historian ever.
Okay. Yeah, we have got to take a break, guys. We'll come right back, and think we're going to have another guest.
Yes.
Stick around. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio.
Healthcare systems, including Virginia's, are now bracing for chaos as Congress fails to fund the Children's Health Insurance Program. According to a new analysis by the Georgetown Center for Children and Families, half of all state CHIP programs will have to shut down by the end of next month. Five states, including Virginia, won't even last that long. Linda Nablo helps run the Virginia Family Access to Medical Insurance Security Program. As Congress has broken repeated promises to deal with the issue, she says they may now have to tell the families of 100,000 children the deadline is coming in a few weeks.
I may now have to mail out another letter saying, no, it's not January 31st, it's much earlier than that. If you're a parent, especially if you're a parent of a very sick child, what do you think?
A plan to fund CHIP by cutting preventive and other care has backing in the House. Congressional leaders set that aside to deal with the big tax bill, including corporate and estate tax cuts. Some House Republicans argue CHIP funding has to be offset to avoid increasing the federal deficit. But as they debate those issues, emergency room doctors say they're planning for when the famous children start showing up after losing coverage, often much sicker than they would be with it. Dr. Sam Bartle at the Children's Hospital of Richmond says he expects to see those parents trying to make heartbreaking decisions about their children's illnesses.
Should I bring them in now or can I wait? Is his wheezing, his difficulty breathing bad enough yet to come in? Can I wait till later and see if it gets better? For some conditions, that can be deadly.
Virginia is not the only state in this situation. Alabama reduced the number of children without coverage to 3%, in part by getting 95,000 into CHIP. Kathy Caldwell says many of those families are starting to panic.
Our phones are ringing off the wall. We have panicked families wondering what in the world they have as options.
Caldwell and Nablo stress as the funding runs low, programs start to see long-term damage. For the Virginia News Connection, I'm Dan Hyman.
Happy holidays from the Union Edge Laborist Talk Radio. So happy that you could join us. This week, we're replaying some of our favorite interviews of the year. Check it out.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thanks for tuning in. We enjoy your company. We appreciate all the great stuff that you're doing for the community. This program is sponsored in part by the Teamsters International and also the Fairfax Education Association. We appreciate their support very much. In studio today, Charlie McAllister.
Hey, great to be here.
Charlie, it's always a pleasure. Hey, you talked to Rosemary. How's the assignment going?
Oh, she's working hard down there. Looking forward to coming back next week.
Yeah, full report. Yeah, yep. There we go. We appreciate it. Hope she recorded lots of interviews. In studio with us also, we've got Wally Jamal. Wally, welcome back.
Thanks.
Always a pleasure. We appreciate it. Charlie, you brought another guest.
Yeah, we have on the phone Larry Glasgow, Dr. Glasgow, professor at the University of Pittsburgh, and most important, though, someone who is writing a biography of August Wilson, who we've talked about some already and are going to talk about for the next hour. August Wilson is arguably the greatest playwright in America, in my opinion. I know there's a couple others that might compete with that, but at any rate, he is so important to the history, the story of this town, to African-American history, and we're really honored to have Larry and Wally, two of the great interpreters of August Wilson, with us today. Welcome, Larry.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thank you. Thank you, Charlie.
So we're excited about some of the things that are going on. Doctor, tell us just a little bit about what you're up to.
Well, for about the last, 8 years, not long after August's death, Chris Rawson at the University of Pittsburgh and I were working on a study of August Wilson and his works and how they relate to Pittsburgh. This sort of morphed into my own personal study of just a biography of August. Originally, we had planned we'd write a thing on, you know, each of August's works is set in a different decade of the 20th century. So we were going to do a thing where Chris Rawson would talk about the play for that decade, and I would talk about what was going on in Pittsburgh for that decade. Well, but that was so ambitious. And we were going to have then an introductory biography on August. It would be just one chapter. Well, I got fascinated with the biography, and that thing has turned into a book now, probably about 500-600 pages. Really, really fascinating material on August, focusing on his Pittsburgh years, because I argue that it was really Pittsburgh that shaped him, that formed his identity, his personality, his life experiences that then come out later in his, first in his poetry and then in his plays. So that's what I've been working on, this Pittsburgh, more focus on the Pittsburgh effect on August Wilson, how that shaped him and how that gets then reflected in his plays.
Yeah,
definitely. The 10-play cycle, I like to say that I'm very honored to have completed the 10-play century cycle by doing King Henry II in Columbus, Ohio, back in November. So I'm the first kid on my block to have all 10 plays under my belt, which makes me a Wilsonian actor. That's a thing now. Being a Wilsonian actor is like a Shakespearean actor.
That's right. That's very good, yeah.
It's very true. Yeah, we last on the Academy Awards to see Viola Davis, I think, gave the most powerful speech. And we were particularly moved, the people connected with the Battle of Homestead Foundation, because Mark Rylance, who had won Best Supporting Actor the year before for Bridge of Spies, is an old friend of ours, a friend of David Demarest. And I met Mark Rylance 15 years ago in a bar in Rankin. And Mark is an enthusiast about Pittsburgh, and he is writing a play on the Homestead Strike that I'm the consultant for. Mm-hmm. Mark, in introducing Viola, I thought was extremely spiritual and profound. He said, I think that the best supporting actor should really be entitled the best opposing actor, because real drama is a question of conflict and opposition and tension, and so that certainly was true in her performance. And he said, and I firmly believe that women, and first of all, he said, and opposition is going to become more and more important in this country, something we're all going to have to train for, or something to that effect. And then he said, and I think women are so much more advanced than men in understanding how to oppose without hatred. And then he gave her the award. I thought that was, and then she knocked it out. He lobbed the pitch up to her, and then she hit the home run. I mean, she went into this incredible, passionate, articulate, beautiful speech, which to me was the highlight of the whole affair.
Sure.
Well, yes, her performance in the movie, she really changed the focus of the play. You know, if you see the play, I think Wally can support this. Definitely. The real conflict is between father and son.
Right.
By the time Viola was finished in the movie, the conflict was husband-wife.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she just really, because her performance was so powerful, it just wrenched the whole thing. I mean, it didn't distort it, but it did give a new dimension to it. And it was an amazing, amazing performance on her part. And I especially liked her comment that August gave voice to the ordinary man and woman, and that was his goal, and that certainly was always his goal, and August did that in ways that we're only now really appreciating, of how he would go out like a newspaper reporter or an anthropologist almost, and walk the streets watching people, how they behaved, how they interacted. He would go into restaurants and bars, barber shops, nightclubs, all sorts of places, and listen to the way they talked.
Absolutely.
And he had a near-perfect memory. He could recall conversations and dialogue years later, almost word for word, along with the gestures, intonation, accents, and everything that went with them. And he was able then to put that in his play. So his plays have a real tenor of authenticity, because he picked up the speech of just ordinary people. And, you know, one of the most famous speeches in that play, one of the most famous dialogues of all August Wilson's, is, remember when the son asked the father, how come you don't like me? And the father goes off and says, who says I gotta like you? Mm-hmm. Don't I put food on your table, clothes on your back, shoes on your feet, on and on and on? And he said, you know why I do that? And the kid messes up again, because you like me. No, because it's my duty. Well, I was talking to one of August's girlfriends, and she talked about how they would walk around the Hill District. And she said they actually heard that conversation, or that dialogue, coming out of a window on Center Avenue.
Wow.
And it really was pretty much said pretty much like he has it in the play.
Wow.
And so he really did capture the language and the statements and the feelings of ordinary people. You know, and he said, ordinary people usually get ignored. People walk right yep. by him, say, "Ah, he doesn't know anything. You know, don't listen to him," or whatever. And he said, in fact, they say some very important things that need to be remembered and should be art. And that was what his big goal was to do, was to transform the thought and language of ordinary people into art.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Guys, I need to stop you there. I'm sorry, we're up against a break. We'll be back very shortly. I'm Charles okay. Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio.
Almost 250 California businesses and children's groups have just sent a joint letter to the state's members of Congress urging them to pass the DREAM Act, which would give certain undocumented kids who were brought to the U.S. as children a work permit and a path to citizenship. President Donald Trump terminated the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, known as DACA, earlier this fall, and an estimated 850 people are thrown into limbo each week. Ted Lempert with Children Now says the situation is taking a terrible emotional toll on families.
We know there's a number of kids who are literally afraid of getting the health coverage they need or even going to school because of the fear of deportation. And there's fear in the family that the parent can be immediately tossed out of the country.
There are 800,000 so-called dreamers in the U.S., a quarter of them living in the Golden State, and 50,000 of them are in jeopardy of being separated from their American-born children. Lempert says he wants the DACA deal to be a part of the year-end spending bill so it gets handled before Congress leaves for their winter break.
You know, there is bipartisan support for this. I think what we're really pushing is to not make this a political football and get it done ASAP and not keep pushing it off.
An estimated 11,000 dreamers have already lost protected status. Thousands of protesters have been rallying in Washington, D.C. this week. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Happy holidays from the Union Edge Laborist Talk Radio. So happy that you could join us. This week, we're replaying some of our favorite interviews of the year. Check it out.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We enjoy your company. We appreciate all the great stuff that you're doing. This program is sponsored in part by ATU 85 and the Iron Workers Local 3, both of the Pittsburgh area. Thanks for your support, guys. In studio today with us, we've got Charlie McCollister.
Great to be here.
Charlie, it's always a pleasure. We appreciate it. Wally Jamal.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming in, man. Sure. We appreciate it. We really, really do. On the phone, we've got Dr. Glasgow. Dr. Glasgow, are you still there?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Fantastic. So I'm sorry that I interrupted the conversation, but, you know, it's amazing. Unfortunately, Dr. Glasgow, you didn't get to hear it. You got to hear our commercials while you're in our system. But, you know, we were just talking about, you know, how the plays and the writing just really honestly, wholeheartedly reflect life. You know, in my estimation, that's probably why it was so effective. Mm-hmm. I mean, people could identify with the one-liners. They could identify with the situation. They could identify with the trials and tribulations. And, you know, one of the things we were talking about before, very early in this interview today, it's not just an African-American issue.
Right.
It's a family issue. It's, you know,
and community issue.
Community issue. It's an American issue.
Yeah, right.
And I think that, at least for me, and I'm, you know, no rocket scientist, but that's why it's so appealing.
Yes, yes. And the thing about August is he really got out in the street, walked the streets, watch people and talk to people and listen to them. You know, he said if he's going to be any good, he can't be writing up in his little room in his apartment. He needs to be out, know people, know what's going on. And he made it a point. He always did that all his life. He wrote out in the street. He wrote in restaurants. He wrote in diners.
Right.
He wrote in nightclubs. He had his little yellow pad there.
I know somebody had stole his seat.
Yeah, I have to tell you a story about that, because back in the early 70s when I was at the learning machining at South Vocational, and I went across the street to this local bar, the Onyx, and I walked in, and it was full of black folk. And I looked at the bartender and I said, am I welcome in here? And he looked at me and he said, what color is your money? And so I went in and I've gone back many times over the years. I was back there after I went and saw Hidden Figures. I had to go down and I was so happy to see the Onyx open because the last few times I had gone down. But anyway, I was sitting there this has to be 15 years ago, writing an op-ed attacking the mayor for closing six or seven of the city pools. And I'm writing away, and the bartender lady, the owner, she comes over and she says, you know, you're the second person who sat in this bar and with a pad and pen and wrote. And I said, oh, really? She said, yeah, the first one was August Wilson. I said, well, that's a hell of a bar to...
wow, that's great. Where is the Onyx?
It's in Southside, right under the 10th Street Bridge. If
no
you
kidding.
Turn going up the street, it's on the left-hand side, and it's quite a...
Right across from the BP station.
Quite a lively place.
I think that's where we're going to have our next remote broadcast.
Yeah. I think we should.
That's a great little hole in the wall.
It is. It's wonderful.
I wonder if they get a spare booth for us.
Well, they'll make one. Just tell them your friends of August, they'll make one.
Yeah, there you go. Gee, that or we'll invoke Charlie McAllister.
No, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think August Wilson would be a better. But tell us, I think, you know, one of the stories that I'd like you guys to talk about, but we don't forget, is about Charlie Burley and
the boxer.
You know, because I had heard about Charlie Burley for years. I put him in my book. Because he was a legendary character, the guy who doesn't get the chance.
Right.
And so tell us a little bit about that, Larry and Wally.
Yeah, sure. Wally, do you want me to?
Oh, sure. Well, right off the top of my head, there was this, while we're talking about little dive bars, there was this little dive bar on Penn Avenue in the Garfield section called Toro's. And I used to drink in there, and they had portraits of Charlie Burley in there. Right behind the bar, right by the top shelf liquor. Yeah, nice pictures of him, too.
And what's that bar called?
Toro's.
Toro's.
I don't know if they're still
like
open.
Oh, the bull, the Spanish bull, Toro. Okay.
Yeah. It used to be just right down the street from a place called the Tiger's Tail that I used to frequent when I was in a band back in the early 80s.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about Charlie Burley.
You know, Charlie Burley was August's neighbor right across the street from where he grew up. And Burley's wife, Julia, was August's mother's best friend. So August spent a lot of time at the Burley residence. The Burleys had a television. The Wilsons didn't have one. So, you know, they were always over there. August wanted to be over there watching some television. And Charlie became like August's surrogate father. You know, August's father was a German immigrant who was a good guy, but he had a terrible drinking problem. He was basically an alcoholic and really wasn't around much. And August really looked for a father figure, and he found it in Charlie Burley. And Charlie used to just roughhouse with August and talk to him and... take him for walks and stuff, and August really patterned himself after Charlie. And August knew that Charlie had never got the break he deserved. He should have been, could have been, you know, world champion, say light heavyweight, but he just couldn't get the fights he needed and he deserved. A lot of guys turned him down. But
the
irony
is punch.
Charlie was never bitter about it. Now, in Fences, that figure, the inspiration came from his knowledge of Charlie Burley, the guy who should have been great, didn't get the breaks. You know, there really was only room for, say, Joe Louis. That was about the only black boxing champion the country was ready for in the 40s. But the irony was Charlie really was not bitter about it. Charlie had a philosophy of life. He said, you know, that's life. He said, you just take the punches and keep going. And August admired that warrior spirit, he called it, of you take a punch, you get knocked down, you get right back up, you don't let it get you down. So he took that as the inspiration. Now, of course, the Troy in the play is different, but Charlie was, Charlie loved his kids, got along well with his sons, you know, his wife, his widow told me. But that became sort of the inspiration for Troy in in the play. You know, Josh Gibson could have been another inspiration. Josh was a guy who, you know, was the leading ball player in the Negro Leagues, didn't get the chance, and he was bitter. He was upset when Jackie Robinson got the break because Josh knew that he was a better player than Jackie, or at least as good, and deserved that chance. But it's probable that the immediate inspiration for the Troy in the play in the movie was Charlie Burley, because that was August's childhood hero. And one thing you see in August, he dressed a lot like Charlie. Charlie was a natty dresser, had his jacket on, his turtleneck sweater, Florsheim shoes, had a cap, you know. He worked, and Charlie could not box. After he retired from boxing, he was a garbage hauler. He worked for the city hauling garbage. And August thought that was just, you know, a real sad, sad ending. But Charlie said, hey, you know, champ, that's the way life is. And he just went on, kept up his pride, was clean, wore fine-looking clothes, was friends to everybody, and was really an inspiration to August of just keep your nose to it and don't give up.
Well, we were talking about the 55-gallon drums
that the garbage men would that the garbage men would do. They would do their thing. I used to watch the garbage men when I was a kid, and they would come with this burlap tarp that they would lay out, and they would take the 55-gallon garbage drum and dump it out onto the burlap tarp, and they take up the corners and tie it up and then haul that to the truck and dump that in there. And it was just amazing that we when we watched that. But to add to what you were saying about Charlie Burley and how he took that, he would say in the play, a recurring line was, you got to take the crookeds with the straights. Talking about, because Troy always spoke in baseball terminology, and that's pretty much it. You got to take the crookeds with the straights.
Well,
Guys, we're coming towards the end of it. We got about 2 minutes left, a little bit longer. Dr. Glasgow, I want to thank you for being with us today. We appreciate it very much. And parting shots for us?
Well, it just had to do with August, his amazing ability with language. He listened to people. He remembered what they said. His language is very authentic. But he did one thing extra with the language. August was a poet first. He was a poet long before he was a playwright. But the poetry comes out in what he did with that language. That is, it's authentic language, but it's also free verse poetry. If you read it properly, it has a rhythm, a cadence, a form to it that really is poetry. And I've talked to actors, and Wally can maybe confirm this. I talked to Eugene Lee about this, and he said, oh, yeah, he said, that stuff, August dialogue, you can't improvise on it. He said, you know, often if you're up there and you get the lines a little mixed up, you know what you're saying, you can improvise and get on through it. But he said, you can't do that with August because every word has to be said like it is because it is poetry.
Yeah.
And he said, that makes it a real challenge. I don't know, Wally, do you find that?
Yes, exactly. And I'm just glad that I'm one of those actors that had gone to Catholic schools and was in advanced reading classes where we learned how to not necessarily speed read, but we learned to develop a photographic memory. So when I'm on stage, I can see the script in my head, and I never lose a line because of that. I thank those nuns. Thank you, Sister Cecilia. But there's a meter. There's a pentameter to August writing, and once you get onto it, I mean, I can recite monologues from all 10 plays because of how they speak to me. In addition to them being just so well written.
Doctor, thank you for being with us today. Wally, we got about 30 seconds. Brother, go ahead.
Well, the thing that resonates with me the most about August Wilson's plays are in every one of them, there are incidents where there is an older black man talking to a younger black man. There's an older man talking to a younger man, and that's what we need, where they'll tell, you know, the guy says, I'm going to have me a ranch and have raise cattle after I get me a woman. And the guy says, get the ranch first. and the woman will come.
There you go. Sage
words
advice.
Of wisdom.
Don't even have to worry about the steers.
Yep. They'll come.
Folks, listen, want you to stick around. Wally, you're going to be here for Point of Pittsburgh, yeah?
Right.
Yep.
Awesome. We appreciate that very much.
And Larry, too.
And Larry, too. Okay, Doctor, you just got recruited. Meantime, folks, do me a favor, please. Stick around for the Point of Pittsburgh. Charlie McCollister, Wally Jamal, Dr. Glasgow. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Are you bored or unsatisfied with your daily activities? Do you long for a new, exciting experience? If the answer is yes and you're under 21 just like me, then you should consider adding a once-a-week KABU Youth Collective meeting to your schedule. Side effects will probably include extreme happiness, uncontrollable fits of laughter, a great group of new friends, and yummy snacks. KABU Youth Collective can cause sudden bouts of inspiration and a yearning to share your words or your inner thoughts with the local community. If joining the collective sounds like a cure for your boredom and lack of an extraordinary after-school activity, then write us at youth@kabu.org or visit us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Or come into one of our Wednesday meetings for a scare-free, risk-free, and always cost-free trial.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up at 10 on KBOO is Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, D-May Roberts speaks to musician Joe Kai about his new album, and he'll perform songs from his album, Migrants. And at 11:30, Art Focus talks to Eric Bone of Metalwood Salvage, a Northeast Portland workshop that takes usable and unique material and turns it into furniture, fixtures, and art. KABU keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to